Welcome to the very first episode of 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology, a podcast about the 69th best show of the 21st century, co-hosted by myself, Ryan Swen, and...
I'm Ian.
Say your full name.
I don't know if I want to say my full name. They might come after me.
There's many forces that could potentially come after you. I feel like that's the overriding message of 24.
Yeah, I'm remaining in a liminal state of anonymity for now. We'll see how that goes.
Many things can change. Many things can change. That's the 24. Everything changes. Everything stays the same. That's the beauty and terror of it.
That's what John Peel said about The Fall. This is basically the television equivalent of The Fall.
So you may be wondering why we're doing a podcast about the acclaimed, reviled, many other things in addition show, the network show on Fox 24 in the year 2021. I think that for us, I think that's precisely why we're interested in it. We're interested in it because it's this sort of time capsule of many things, but particularly this strange moment or this strange state of being, this strange state of existence that the show effectively stumbled into. It happened to land right at the right time, just in some strange confluence of events, and it became this sort of exemplar of America, of America's sort of view, of America's paranoia during the post 9/11 era, the Bush era, the Iraq War era, and I think that was what intrigued us. But also, it's a show that we have a good deal of affection for, or at least a good deal of fascination with.
Yeah, affection. I think affection remains to be seen now. Like, I think I don't think we would be interested in this if we hadn't, enjoyed the show on at least like an entertainment level when we both watched it previously. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know about you, but I think I've established that season five, I think, was the first one I watched in real time after, you know, like renting the DVDs and watching through the show before that. That's like halfway through the show, picking up on that week to week schedule. And in the years since, it's sort of something that I kind of like knew as a thing that I've, you know, consumed at some point. But but like much of the culture have like moved on from and forgotten in some ways. So I'm excited to like go back to it and see if it is as rich a text as we maybe suspect it might be.
Yeah, definitely. I actually, when I started, it was in the middle of season seven. It wasn't even at the beginning, it was just in the middle. It's just somehow that's where my family started watching in earnest, watching sort of week to week following that. So I watched season seven and eight and Die Another Day when that came on a few years after. I watched those week to week, but the rest of them I watched in a sort of, not quite binge, but sort of like a, I don't know, like a haze, because I was usually on the treadmill just doing exercises. So I would usually watch half episodes or something like that per time. Somehow I made it through all six prior seasons that way. So I haven't watched the full episode since since that time. Probably Live Another Day. I think I mistook it with the James Bond film of the same era. which we may discuss, which leads us into sort of our sort of structure and our sort of intent on how we're going to put this show out and make it through the 192 plus episodes that this show comprises.
Yeah, I think IMDb says like 200 and something. I don't know if it's counting. I will say I don't know if it's counting the movie in that. I think the movie is like a separate IMDb entry.
Yeah, I think so. But yes, it's a lot of episodes, and we know that going in. But we do plan to cover the entire run of the show, plus Live Another Day, plus Legacy, and also. Whatever sort of other things that catch our fancy that like we think is worth talking about in relation to the show, but also in relation to the period. So we'll be doing two episodes per podcast episode, bi-weekly, so that's every 2 weeks, and we'll try to keep that schedule as well as we can. We both have other obligations, other sort of more pressing obligations in terms of academics and job prospects and things like that. But I think our intent with this is sort of just to keep this fun and to keep this informal, but also trying to keep it insightful. We're not trying to make a sort of fan podcast in that specific sense. Like, we're trying to approach it from a critical lens, but also it's just simply unavoidable that the show is insane in many ways and pleasurable within that insanity. So I think we're going to try to capture the spirit of that just throughout.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a lark for now, but also, you know, I think as I was watching these first episodes, you know, I couldn't help but think of all of the other things that we maybe want to bring into conversation with the show. Not even stuff that seems as directly related, like, you know, like the 24 video game is something I know we want to talk about.
Yes.
Just, you know, it kind of runs through this really, formative period, I think, for us because of our age, and for the culture, right? From the early Bush era into the early Obama era, and then even stretching into kind of like you know, the sort of gray-haired Obama era with Live Another Day, right? I'm just really interested to see how the show changes and also how it doesn't over the course of that. And then to periodically, you know, hopefully depending on our schedules and, you know, whether or not this is still fun for us, to dip into these other things that we might want to do to take snapshots of the rest of the culture at this time. Cause I think, like, watching these episodes, I was sort of reminded of, like, how hermetic the show feels, how the conceit in some ways kind of locks it into a place a little bit outside culture. Although I think there's, like, in the first episode, there's, like, a Sublime song and, like, a Tricky song that plays in the background.
I forgot how much music there was, like, licensed music in these first two episodes. I don't know if that continues, but it's a large amount.
Yeah, and it's, well, and, like, in the first episode, at least, a lot of it was diegetic, too, which right. I thought was an interesting choice as well. Like, kind of, you know, taking the conceit maybe beyond, like, just the mere gimmick that it is on the surface.
Yeah, I think the sort of time capsule element extends just to technology and to the cultural sense that it has. Obviously, the cultural sense, I feel like it probably will recede a great deal as they focus more on the procedural or thriller sort of thing. But it's still there, and it's still sort of interesting to see, like, how technology changes how people relate to that. And the show's, like, really well situated just because it was released, I think, pretty regularly, like, in terms of seasons. Like, it was just running, and it ran for such a long time. So I think we can mine a lot from that. And going back to what you said about sort of, like, our perspectives, and, like, I think that it's important to note, like, just our perspectives. Like, we're both leftists. I think you're, like, more so than I am. I guess
I'm a filthy communist, Ryan.
I'm definitely leaning towards that. It's still very much a thing in flux, as with politics and identity and things like that. And so I think that, like, just having that perspective is going to color the way we see it. And I'm a bit younger than you, so when I was growing up, essentially with the war, and with the sort of, like, just with understanding or not really grasping the actual, like, what it actually entailed, just simply beyond simply being a sort of state of existence, just something that I accepted that was just always there. And also, like, growing up, like, I was definitely, due to the influence of parents and culture and where I was living, it was, like, definitely a more conservative thing. And so when I was growing up, it was 24 was as much a show that I knew because I loved it, but also because it's my dad's favorite show. It was my pastor's favorite show. So, of course, I think, was it? Yeah, it's Bush's favorite show also. So, like, so those things were sort of definitely color my the way I see it. And I think that's definitely a huge part of why I'm interested in it. It's just this way of reckoning with this strange state of being that the U.S. was plunged into or plunged itself into over that decade or so.
Yeah. Can I ask you a personal question?
Of course.
Do you remember where you were on 9/11?
No, I don't. That's the thing.
Oh, shit. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ryan will be doing outreach to our Gen Z listeners, and yeah. I will be interpreting what he says for the more geriatric among us. I'm not even that much older than you, but yeah, that is a separating line, I think. Although, you know, for our differences, I do think that one of the reasons we both had such an early engagement with the show is that I think we did grow up in sort of similar situations, even mm-hmm. though we grew up in different parts of the country. I don't know about my pastor's opinion of the show, but I watched this show with my mom, and my dad watched it with us as well, although he has a habit, which he maintains to this day, where, you know, you'll be watching something sort of particularly like a series over the course of, you know, weeks and months. And my dad is an early to bed kind of person. So he will miss, you know, whole episodes, sometimes many episodes, and then he'll dip back in and he'll need to be filled in on what's going on. So that was a common occurrence with the show, at least before we started watching it weekly. And then I think at that point, probably we generally watched it all together. But it is, you know, I think it is a particular, it's funny watching this first episode because like you mentioned a little bit ago, it is kind of an accident that the show fell in when it did, you know. I think that there was, it was even up in the air because it was even up in the air whether they would complete the first season because 9/11 kind of intervened and they sort of felt like, well, is this a kind of thing that people will watch if it's on TV, you know, is it too traumatizing? Is it too soon? It's definitely in this first season, at least, a show that is much more influenced by the kind of like terrorist plots of the 90s, you know, something like Die Hard or something like that. But it happened to arrive right place, right time. I don't think there's any way the show lasts as long as it does in a slightly different version of our world. And so, yeah, I think for a certain swath, probably a fairly wide swath of the culture that was taking it in at the time, it served a little bit as a channel for a certain kind of impotent anger that was present in American society, and also like it's a fantasy in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's a fantasy of defeating the invisible enemy, right? Which is both like internal and external. I think that's something I had sort of forgotten about the show until returning to it, is how much of this is not just about, you know, threats coming from outside, but how the internal and external are intimately tied up. You know, there are double agents and moles and domestic hate groups, you know, being invoked here in the first episode, right? And, you know, like the terrorist database and some other things that feel like they're still very present in the way that we talk about the American sort of presence abroad and the way that has kind of manifested itself at home as well. So I found that stuff really interesting to remember and return to, because I wasn't expecting it to be quite so complex from the jump.
Mm-hmm. Partly because there's just so much time to fill and so much that needs to go on, but credit to them, at least in these first two episodes, it is packed, and it is the way that I forgot just how much it's juggling all these different storylines and ratcheting up the tension on every single one of them. It's very much endemic to the progression of the show. I assume simply because it must, that it has to slow down, but at least these first two episodes is very present from the jump. And we should say also that we don't plan on doing, like, we're going to talk about, oh, this is what happens in episode one, this is what happens in episode two. It's not going to be as linear as that. We will ground our discussions in the episodes themselves, but we'll almost certainly, just because we have seen it before and just sort of have retained at least the general outlines, so we will be invoking later events and things that we remember. I think I have not a leg up, but I have a sort of different perspective, simply because even though I haven't watched a show in so many years, I've still frequently done wiki dives and following hyperlinks and chains and things like that. So I do have a greater retention of details and of further upcoming things than you do. But we'll try to keep it only like as restrained as possible, while still going off in these tangents. And should say also that each episode will probably be around an hour, but I think this one will be longer simply because we have to do this intro.
Yeah. I don't have that continuing relationship with the show, which is sort of why I think I'm interested in going back. One thing I do want to point out, you know, if we're being very explicit about it, is that this is definitely not, you know, in addition to the sort of recent string of shows that take a sort of loving or nostalgic look at a particular property, you know, episode by episode. One of the things I noticed in watching these first two is that 24 really loves the red herring. And so to some degree, to talk about plot at this micro level of the show just doesn't make a lot of sense, especially since I don't think anybody watching this is going to be watching it. You know, anybody who chooses to watch this show now will be watching it at the kind of slow pace that is kind of assumed by these diversions, right, away from maybe who we ought to be looking at, you know, who we ought to be worried about when they're in the frame. So I think partially one of the reasons I'm not too interested in talking about plot is that I think we could spend 20 minutes talking about something like that and then just the next week realize we're wrong and that it was a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because I think I already had to kind of go back and correct some of my notes from episode one after watching the second one and being like, oh yeah, this is not this person. I remembered this incorrectly.
Right. Yeah. The sort of plot by plot progression, like it definitely can work, but I think that we'll try to talk, I guess, in broader strokes, but it's just sort of like there's many things just to pick at and just sort of fascinate over. It's not necessarily, I wouldn't say like nostalgic is the right term, but like there's a certain appreciation. Like, we're not doing this just to bag on it. I don't think that'd be a fun experience.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point as well. You know, to some degree, I think that I find the show interesting enough to sign up for a project like this. I hope it remains interesting enough. That was maybe my one worry. This is not, I actually think, while, you know, the show certainly is reactionary in a lot of ways, I think it has, because of the culture at the time and because I think so much of our politics has changed, like, in a lot of different ways, there aren't kind of these solidly crystallized archetypes, you know. I think there are interesting things going on in the show, despite maybe what the creators of the show intended, right? And I think that anything like this, you know, a show that's as collaborative as a big network TV drama has to be, is going to have interesting convergences of you know, politics and filmmaking, even, right? I mean, I think to some degree, the way that this is shot lends itself to a more complex view of what's happening, even as the show certainly does have a kind of delight in violence as a way to excite the viewer, right? It's certainly how the show kind of keeps up its relentless pace, you know, in between people being on the phone a lot. that's certainly one way in which the motor of the show works. But yeah, I mean, all that being said, you know, I think these early episodes so far are showing that we are maybe onto something here in talking about it, because I was surprised by how much there was that was there.
To get into the episodes themselves, I knew we, like I said, we won't do the plot by plot or like point by point progression, but I think we have to talk about how this starts in Kuala Lumpur. Like it says it begins at midnight, but then it immediately switches to what, 4 p.m. like Malaysia time.
Yeah,
for its very first scene.
I watched the episode twice because my partner wanted to watch it with me as well. And the first time I watched it, I was so confused what Kuala Lumpur had to do with anything. It honestly wasn't until the second time I viewed it that I was like, oh, I sort of get what's going, like, I understand there's like, this is where maybe the information is coming from or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it still does not present itself as a, it's a weird choice. Like it,
yes.
Given what the rest of the show does, it's sort of like, you forget about it very quickly that this is where it begins. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like it begins there. And it takes a good like 6 minutes before Jack Bauer actually appears himself on screen.
Yes. Yeah.
It's sort of this weird, it's not even like a progression of information to him because it begins with his sort of domestic problems.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get into that a lot over the course of this show, but it's this strange, but like, so it's just more like setting up, oh, this is going to be a thriller first, right? Or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. And I think one of the reasons I think it does that is this first season in particular definitely feels like it is primarily viewing itself as like an espionage show, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because of the real-time conceit, that makes it very hard, you know, to have like a globe-trotting James Bond type figure, right? So
true.
I think if I remember correctly from, you know, the rest of the show, one of the things it does is it gives us plot lines that are taking place very far away. And mm-hmm. and part of the nature of the show, you know, as you watch season by season, is the way in which these further plot lines begin to converge with, you know, Jack Bauer in LA primarily. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that this from the very first, you know, few minutes of the show, you get both this kind of international espionage flavor. And it also conveys this sort of visual language of the show as well. You know, we get mm-hmm. that those like juxtaposed shots of like the towers in Kuala Lumpur and then like the street level. And then we zoom in on the guy kind of looking around and which I don't think I don't think that visual language is always used to the best extent that it could be, but I think particularly right. in those kind of establishing moments of the show, it signals itself as something maybe very different than what was on TV at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think maybe there's something to it, like just the way that it focuses initially on these more, I don't know, like it begins, like the first LA scene is with the soon to be deceased CTU official at some random dinner party
yeah,
at midnight.
Yeah. what is up with
that? I forgot about like the dinner party
yeah.
or him. I don't know. It's just like it's just a function, just the
yeah, it's just some
just
kind
something.
Of
something.
Some kind of deep state sicko function.
I do like how it goes from there to a David Palmer's like just hold up in a hotel and with his campaign headquarters.
Yeah, I had, you know, something yeah. I had totally forgotten is that the big background of the plot in the first season is the California presidential primary. Mm-hmm.
And it's mentioned in the opening voiceover.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is the day of the California primary, which I did not look up to see when the primary actually falls or when it fell then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's made to seem very important in the campaign,
yeah.
I think.
I think it's supposed to be like on, is that typically a Super Tuesday state or?
Maybe it is.
Yeah. But like it's specifically California. And like,
yeah.
I think it's mentioned later on that he's a Democrat. So I think, like obviously there's a big base there, but still like, I don't know. I don't remember. And we'll see as the show goes along or as the season goes along, but just like how much it actually pays attention to the other challengers and to like the other, like the actual substance of a primary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we get in these first two episodes, you know, I don't think it's directly stated, you know, cause it does take place a little bit in kind of a sideways, version of America. You know, you have this counterterrorism right. unit, you have these agencies that don't exist. Right. So I think it sort of makes a point to avoid explicitly naming Palmer's politics, but we get a, you know, the California primary is, it's not as important in the Republican race, right? And then also we get the guy that Jack tranquilizes.
George Mason.
George Mason, yeah. I was like, it's like yes. a name of like a, it's the name of the university. Yeah, okay. Yeah, and he makes some kind of passing comment to Jack about Palmer, you know, not being a friend of the agency. Yeah. Right?
Completely forgot about that.
Yeah. You know, I have a sort of hypothesis that I have sort of begun to form that I'm wondering if it bears out, which is that this show will I'm so surprised that it hasn't had a renaissance among sort of like resistance liberal type people, particularly because like Jack Bauer is presented, you know, even very early on in the show as like a kind of stand up guy, right? Like he rats people out in his agency who were taking bribes and stuff like that. And you know, he's protecting this guy, you know, David Palmer, who, you know, would probably like gut the agency if he got elected or whatever. He seems like a preeminent kind of resistance figure, like just a guy with a family, you know, who loves his country and is trying to do a good job, right? So I'm interested to see whether or not that idea plays out in any meaningful way over the course of the show, or whether it's just kind of like table setting before we get to like the real stuff.
Yeah, I had completely forgotten that his first scene is just him at home playing chess, curled up with wearing sneakers, curled up in an armchair.
Man, what on earth is he wearing? He's got like a shirt that's like half sweatshirt, and he's got these like sort of swishy sweatpants on, and these big old sneakers, and he's sitting in this chair. Like his feet are on the chair. He's like Spider-Man sitting while he plays chess with his daughter at midnight. Then it's like it's time for bed. It's a school night. It's very it's a little bit student filmy, I think, in those early moments, and not in a bad way. It's shot in kind of an interesting way to start with that wide shot of him and his daughter over the chessboard. And the way that it's like framed and blocked is someone on set was thinking about these things, which I appreciate.
Yes. Yeah, we'll get into the form. When you mentioned the sort of juxtaposed shots, of course, like there's that sort of just in terms of, like the shooting from the air, shooting from the ground, that I forgot that this actually does a good deal of.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of helicopter shots.
Yes.
But I have forgotten just how much of the split screens were, if not redundant, there was just sort of like a shooting almost the same angle, but it was just in different screens.
Yeah, there's two moments for me that sort of exist at the opposite poles of the way that this style works or doesn't. And like a good one is when, you know, Mason does the like fake call from Jack's office and Jack walks down and goes and picks up the train. Like I think that it's really the multiple angles and the different frames are doing a really interesting kind of work there, both because I think CTU is kind of an interesting space just architecturally, the way that they set it up.
Definitely.
Like there's lots of interesting angles and lighting and stuff like that. It's a very dramatic space. And this scene is, cause we're not really sure what he's doing either. Like we have two scenes of this character, and one is sort of like, you know, he's kind of like a put upon husband and father who may be, you know, him and his wife are back together, but it seems like he just recently moved back in, you know? And then we go to him like being like a boss who's kind of like a hard ass, but you know, people seem to respect him a little bit. And then he just goes totally sicko mode in this scene. And the lead up to that is like one of the most dynamically shot moments in either of these episodes. Like it's just like, it's doing all kinds of work. Cause you got Mason in the office, you got Nina watching Jack and kind of going up to him, and you have Jack looking around at the office to kind of make sure nobody sees what he's doing. And so you're getting these other angles. But then a little bit later on, it might even be in the same episode. I don't remember if it's in the first or second episode, but Jack is on the phone with his wife, who's in the car with the other parent. And there's three angles. And one of them is just like a close-up of Jack on the phone. And the other one is like a medium shot of like straight on at the car with, his wife in the passenger seat and this other guy in the driver's seat. And then the other one is like just like a profile shot of them in the car. Like, it's just like, it's not giving us really anything visually, because the guy in the driver's seat is not, he's not doing anything. He's just driving the car. Like, there's nothing really interesting going on there, but it's sort of like they felt the need for some reason to put that third, to put that third screen up there. Like, it's sort of like they have this interesting tool and this interesting language that they maybe don't know how to always use, right?
Right. And of course, it's like these split screens that are like, they're not full on split screens. They're just sort of like little cutouts that are just plastered throughout. And it's just like, it's introduced like very casually, but it's just such an integral part of the show's language that it's often baffling just why, like, it's sort of, I don't know, maybe there's something about like the sort of bong that comes in when a new screen is open that creates like a source of tension.
Yeah, like, and each episode kind of ends with these like screens coming up and like receding behind the countdown, right? Mm-hmm. I do think though, obviously some of that that visual language comes off as being somewhat indebted to like comic books, right? It definitely just the way that it's laid out looks like suggests that and looks like that. But also, whether or not it's intended this way, one can't help but think of like the implications of this, basically like surveillance agency that seems to have no real oversight, right? Like they're just like breaking into buildings and getting people's email passwords, maybe this is a stretch and maybe I'm just looking for something where there is nothing, but I'm interested to see if that surveillance angle kind of plays in, right? And whether or not one of the ways that this language might be used is to remind us that many of these characters are, if not actually physically being watched, their movements are being tracked, right? Like there is a way in which that, like particularly that scene with Mason up in the office, where we get all these multiple angles and then we're back in the office and we don't get that anymore, right? And so all of a sudden the field of our vision as viewers and by proxy, like the people looking at this scene happening are not seeing Jack, like assault this guy, right? and knock him out. So I do think there's like interesting stuff going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find it fascinating how quickly it's introduced, like sort of the nature of the surveillance, like that one when right after he calls Nina in the second episode and immediately I think it's in the same shot, Tony just pulls up the audio transcript of what they're calling about. It's just so quick.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't know if it's like, it's not even necessarily something that's brought up. I don't remember if that's actually like, it's just like another element in him sort of Tony's early distrust of Jack, but it's just so quickly done. And it's just interesting to see how the technology intersects. Like the, like you said, him enlisting Jamie, who I completely forgot about. I forgot about a lot of the characters. But her just like agreeing to hack into Kim's things just and then, it's important. He just says it's important.
And then I had to make note of this because I just was cackling when they get the password and the password is life sucks. One word. Like that's what Jack says on the phone. I don't think there's a lot to talk about in the Kim plot yet, because it's not interesting, but it is definitely an old person's idea of what young people get up to.
Oh, certainly. I forgot how, like, I don't know, it like puritanical for more or less. Like there's a certain, like there's like a strong sort of element of that. Like the, I don't know, like them horrified at seeing a condom wrapper or like,
yeah, they find joints in her room. Yeah. And it's like, they, on the one hand, you can see on their faces, they're kind of trying to balance a certain kind of, emerging, 21st century practicality about these kinds of things, but they're also both like really horrified by this. Right. But at the same time, it's like, obviously as the season goes on, we realize that maybe this initial interaction is not all it seems to be, but it's like, they go to a furniture store and like drink some booze and like just kind of wiggle around like to music. Yeah, and of course, then, you know, in the second episode, you know, we realize that Janet, Kim's friend, has been roofied, right? And there's it definitely takes a sinister turn. Still, though, I think informed by like a grown adult writing about the year is 2001. What are the kids getting up to? You know?
Yeah. Like I've forgotten just how much time the Terry and Kim stuff takes up, and like at this point, like it's just her trying to look for Kim and Kim in this undefined circumstance.
Yeah.
Like, I think they say Ira Gaines' name at the end of the second episode, but otherwise, like, it's just this strange time. And it's just weird. Like, it's just weird interspersing this with the other more obviously motivated stuff. I think it's partly because of the whole main cast thing.
Yeah.
They're all main cast, but it's still such a strange intervention. I also like how the two boys are specifically San Diego State sophomores. It's just, I don't know why they're up in LA either. Well, I mean, they're up for ulterior motives, but still, like, it's just weird, like, why it's specifically San Diego State.
Yeah, and I like to think someone, I like to think one of the writers or the creators or something has some kind of beef with San Diego State, or maybe their nemesis went there or something. You know, I think this is a good example of the way that the show works, is that plot line starts off as being kind of like a very minor, like, domestic problem on top of these big national security things that, you know, to some degree the viewer is supposed to have some investment in, but is not revealed to be, you know, part of this broader thing until later, right? You know, we begin to realize that these things are connected, right? As a very small side note, I couldn't corroborate this, but on the IMDb trivia page, it appears that the actor who plays Janet's dad was actually originally supposed to play Jack Bauer.
Yes. I heard, that's on the 24 Wiki. We'll be referring to Wiki 24 a lot during the course of this run. The key source.
The series Bible, along with this copy of the torture papers that I got at the bookstore the other day, put out by Cambridge University Press.
I'm sure we'll be referring to that a lot. But yeah, like, apparently he was one of the main people, and then they decided to bring in Kiefer Sutherland because he was like a bigger name, and also the director of these first two episodes, Stephen Hopkins, was a good friend of Kiefer Sutherland, so he managed to get him in.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, see, you have the insight here that I was lacking, because on the IMDb trivia page, it's sort of just kind of glossed over. Like, there's no rationale behind this.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and I think the show, it definitely lacks... I want to put this in a diplomatic way, because I have to watch many more hours of this show. But in these early episodes, everybody does seem to kind of be sleepwalking except for Kiefer.
That's probably fair. Like, it's sort of like, it's more like hinting at, or like sort of gesturing towards a urgency that Kiefer just has. Like, even Dennis Haysbert, like, there's sort of like he's like sort of there, but he's also not there. Like, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, I think his character is not given a lot to do right away. And if I recall correctly, you know, I think Haysbert has he can access a certain kind of intensity that eventually the kind of like scenes call for. But you know, right now he's sort of like, he's a little bit in amiable politician mode. Of course, by the end of episode two, we kind of realize something else is going on. But
I think he handles those scenes well. Yeah. Like, just sort of that sort of furtiveness. I like how he is like scratching his eye when he's walking past those two people in the parking lot.
Yeah.
it's like a tactical maneuver.
Yeah.
It's fun seeing that. I mean, like, it's also fun how he just slips out effortlessly from the hotel.
Yeah, you know, here's a presidential candidate. He just like walks out the back door, you know, right before Secret Service arrives.
Yeah. I forgot also Aaron Pierce came in so early.
Yeah, I had totally forgotten about him, but like, he's fairly major, you know, as the show goes on. Yeah, you know, as far as the rest of the cast goes, I want to give them a little bit of a break, because, you know, Kiefer, like, this is really his piece here, especially these first two episodes, you know. Like we referred to already, he all of a sudden this switch kind of flips in his performance where like I was surprised at how quickly he became, you know, Jack Bauer, right?
Yeah.
Without a lot of warning. Yeah, you know, he's gonna be pretty much turned up to 10 the rest of the show.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, like I forgot, like it's the sort of, I forgot that he was like actually in the like position of like delegating duties.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning, and so it's fun just watching him order people around and especially put pressure on Tony.
Yeah, yeah.
I forget. Yeah, Tony has like a big just part like immediately.
Pensively, sipping out of his Cubs mug, you know, scheming with his soul. Yeah.
Soul patch. Apparently, also both Leslie Hope, who plays Terry, and Sarah Clark, who plays Nina, they were cast on the day that filming began.
I read that Sarah Clark literally just had to wear her own clothes throughout the whole show because they didn't have time to like do wardrobe or makeup. So honestly, I think that she was very smart to do that because you're probably much more, I imagine you're much more comfortable in your own clothes than you are in, you know, what the wardrobe people outfit you with.
Maybe, but also like having to wear the exact same pair of clothes for a lot of filming.
That's true. I wonder if it's the exact pair or if they had to like go out and buy like duplicates of the same thing. I read that they filmed the pilot on the Fox Sports soundstage.
I think
And then they had to like recreate CTU when they got like the series order.
Yeah, it's a there are certain, I don't know, differences might not be the right term, but like it still feels, even though it's a pilot, it still feels like 24 basically off the bat, like different sounds and things like that. The clock is not quite as thunderous as it is in the very next episode, but it's definitely like, it definitely feels all of a piece immediately. Like there's a certain, that sort of column per segment aside, it just launches right in.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of what's fun about it, is that sort of procedural, you are there immediacy. Well, of course we can dispute whether that's actually fully carried out, but it's definitely like very much a part of the show's mandate from the get-go. I think a lot of what helps with that is just that Jack is just moving so much and just calling so many people.
Yeah.
He's just immediately introducing you to other people through his conversations.
Yeah, and by the second episode, you know, he's already flown the coop, right? Which is, I think, kind of key to the way, again, the show keeps up this momentum is, you know, and another thing, too, is like, I mean, on some level, I'm a little bit, you can't help but be a little bit impressed by, like, the commitment to the conceit and the way in which, like, you know, yeah, we do have to have, like, a few minutes at least of Jack just driving around in his SUV, you know, in between places. Right. And, you know, I think that one could potentially criticize the show, you know, because it has commercial breaks, right? So now if you watch them without it, it's like they're 40, 41 or 42 minutes or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the way that the show sort of strategically uses the commercial breaks to kind of pass through some time where nothing's really happening. I mean, I think it's like there's a lot of coordination that has to go on there. And one of the results of that is that the show feels very much of a piece from the start. Like there doesn't, everything kind of had to be like in a row already, unlike a sitcom or a more episodic show. You know, they really had to know, they had to have their dots kind of connected already in a way that I think shows up in the first episode as the pieces are being put in place.
It's just very, it's serial right from the get go. And we, speaking of the conceit, we do have to talk about the ludicrous amount of mentions of time in this, showcasings of time in these first episodes. There's literally two moments in these first two episodes where someone says for the next 24 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's
they really need you to know what the show is doing.
Yes, and like George Mason calls a time opera. I always love those, like when those come up.
Yeah,
like when those are shown, like I would. Like, I still think it'd be cool to have those, even though people don't call as much, and obviously that's actually available on your phone. It's just fun to see. Does people, like, have an operator say, the time right now is this? I don't know. There's something oddly, not quaint about it, but, like, there's something Like, I just like it.
Yeah, the show I think shows the superiority of landlines to cell phones at this time, right?
Yeah.
Terry and Jack are on the phone, and the service drops out, and but the landline, you know, as a way, you know, to keep time and also to like guarantee a certain kind of direct communication, like uninterrupted. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, I'm really interested to see, as you know, technology evolves in the culture, how the show changes with it, because it's sort of like all of the surveillance stuff they do, all of the like counterterrorism stuff they do, is like basically works like magic, you know. Like they can look up an address and get all of the, you know, key codes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think at this point, you know, writers were still finding it convenient to interrupt stuff like cell service, right, for dramatic purposes. And I wonder, you know, how that looks different in, say, you know, 2008, where, you know, Los Angeles probably had much better cell service.
Yeah. Yeah. I also forgot how there's a strong, like, greater LA component to it. Like, all the stuff with Terry and Kim is taking place in the valley, in the San Fernando Valley. So it's like, I'm living in Los Angeles. You aren't, but like, there's a, like, it's just, I don't actually remember where CTU, if they say where CTU is located within LA. But it's West LA. Wow. West LA.
Well, my sense is that they sort of, you know, having not been to LA and not being a person who lives there, my guess would be that they're doing a lot of fudging geographically because of the time thing, right?
That's true,
although, yeah. I think they get around it a little bit by the fact that, you know, it's in the middle of the night to start the show, at least. I do know that the garage in the second episode is in Glendale, which made me think of the Tim Heidecker song in Glendale. that's where they filmed it. That's where they filmed it anyways. And I think that's, I would assume that's sort of where it is at in the show, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, apparently the furniture store was actually a real stores. I mean, I guess it makes sense because it's fairly big.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah.
Apparently, there's going to be a lot of places I'm tempted to visit. We'll see actually manage to make it.
Is it Punch Drunk Love where with the furniture store and Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Well, there is a furniture store. It's not the same.
Yeah, story. No. But I just imagine, you know, we never. In my head canon is that Philip Seymour Hoffman is the owner of that furniture store for as well, and is just sleeping the night away, not knowing that these, you know, rowdy youngsters have mussed his wonderful Rococo style furniture.
Yeah, I love how the parents spend a good 15 minutes just cleaning up.
Yeah. Like, such dweebs.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they try to call the guy, like, and they just walk into his store. I mean, I'm assuming it's still unlocked from, like, when the kids were there or whatever, but, like, yeah, they just walk in and then they just start to clean the mess up. But, I don't know. I don't feel like they're there long enough to clean everything up.
Yeah.
So maybe a little courtesy thing, like, hey, sorry, our kid messed up your lamps or whatever.
Going back to the real-time thing, I love how there's little glimpses at just characters that are just there for a scene and then leave, like, yeah. When he calls her Kim's ex,
yeah,
and he's just shirtless playing PlayStation. You have a clock in the background.
Did you I had to rewind and look. Did you notice his back tattoo?
No, I didn't.
In big gothic letters it says Irish. It's fantastic. Again, definitely an old person's idea of what a young delinquent boyfriend would be like. You know, he's like playing video games without a shirt on and like smoking cigarettes and has spiky hair and a back tattoo that's Irish.
Yeah, and on the other end of the youngster spectrum, the David Palmer's kids, like they've come from, apparently they've been leading a rally and Green Day was playing.
I wrote down this quote because I was dying. Let me see if I can. Oh yeah. So his son is like, just as I'm finishing, Green Day starts to play Time of Your Life. It's like, what is this, like a graduation? Yeah. man, again, just like, no offense to the people working on this show, but the most of the supporting cast, and partially by virtue of the fact that they're not in it for very much so far, most of the supporting cast is just kind of like, they're not given a lot to work with.
Right.
And like, one of the problems of the real-time conceit is like, you know, when you know, Jack isn't in a firefight or doing something exciting, you have to have a lot of people just kind of like milling around and talking in a way that is casual, but also like is advancing the plot in some way. Again, I get the feeling that in the earlier part of the season, that'll be more prevalent than in the later parts of the season, where I think all of the plot lines are in some kind of soap opera like high tenor of like action drama, right?
Yeah, like there's a air of menace like in the Kim scene.
Yeah,
but like it's not quite just like it just doesn't feel quite explicated in a way that feels like very, very compelling. Like it's just like her like in a van with these two guys.
Yeah, just in the Mystery Machine.
It does kind of look like that.
Again, it's a big purple van with no windows and like shag carpet inside.
I mean, when you said earlier that Alan York was like just driving, I was very strongly tempted to quote the James Austin Johnson. He doesn't drive the plot. He does drive the narrative.
Yeah,
this is going to be week to week, or like by like 2 weeks to 2 weeks, so this is going to be very current. Forewarning to the listeners, this is going to involve a lot of that stuff.
We'll see how this goes. I do think, okay, this did remind me that maybe the only plot thing that we haven't touched on is the plane.
Yes,
right. Which I think,
well, the Mandy stuff in general,
yeah,
which I actually like a lot.
Yeah.
So
one of the things, like one of the products of me not having watched the show in a while is that I a little bit fell for the, again, the red herring in this, which is that you have this, this sinister sounding, what is he, like German photographer German. Or something. And we've been told already that the shooter is German, right? So he's just like dripping in sweat and just this, you know, this,
he's like from a De Palma, he's like a Antonio Banderas's character in Femme Fatale.
Yes, yeah. And his skin is like all sallow and he sort of speaks in this weird voice. Then of course he's with this you know, he begins flirting with this lady sitting next to him, right? She asks him if he met Princess Di and is like, what was she like? And he's like, she was cool. Like that's but like, so I had sort of forgotten that this guy is you know, one of the first victims on the show and not in fact an important person in the long run really at all. But yeah, that's kind of how I think that's a good microcosm of the way that the show really introduces a lot of plot points, which is you begin by either like being presented with something that's obviously like wrong, or like by a thing that seems maybe nondescript that won't be, and then next thing you know, a plane of people is blowing up and isn't really talked about a lot again because of things that happen outside of the show.
Yeah, I think that like he's introduced, like he's like the last thing you see before the first commercial break.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as this like first, oh, this is the guy, this is the assassin, and he's just this sleazy fashion photographer.
Yeah, he sounds like Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Also, that plane is just incredibly nice, like that, like they have an entire, like it didn't really look like specifically first class, like it, like,
yeah,
it, I guess this was another thing that 9/11 took from us.
Yeah, it was another era. Was, you know,
yeah,
you could
have a bar in the middle of the plane.
Yeah, you could have a bar in the middle of the plane. It had a staircase. You can smuggle explosives in the zipper of your suitcase.
I'm sure this will be reflected later on, but I forgot just how, like, obviously I wasn't really conscious of pre 9/11 security measures, airplane security measures. So this sort of thing would be immediately outdated, like when this, well, actually, to be fair, I don't know exactly when all of the, you know, detector stuff and x-rays and whatnot were introduced, but I forgot, but it's almost effectively outdated immediately because this aired, like you'll be hearing this on the 20th anniversary of the show, which of course comes 2 months after the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And so it's like they had to cut out the actual shot of the plane exploding because of 9/11. So you just get the sort of like embers or debris coming off as you see Mandy parachuting out.
And it's a very dark shot too. Like you don't you get the idea of what's happened without really, because she sets up that bomb that was like in the fire extinguisher, right? I think one of the interesting things about this show is that they're, you know, it's filmed in April of 2001, I think, is when they wrapped right. production. Mm-hmm. And so it comes at the end of this, you know, 10-year period, this decade of like uncertainty. You know, the Cold War ends. This is another reason why the show's interesting to me, at least. You know, the Cold War ends, and you know the big, you know, antagonist on, you know, the international stage in the eyes of like the U.S. Is gone, and so then you have to begin to like look for danger elsewhere, right? And 24. You know, in a world where, you know, 9/11 and war in Iraq and the war on terror and all this stuff just does not go the way it goes, like 24 would have just been another in a series of like, bizarre Eastern Europeans choosing to blow up, you know, train stations or kill U.S. politicians, you know. Mm-hmm. And it develops into something far more sinister as the show goes on because of, you know, events in history. But you know, early on here, it's like it still is. And I don't remember, maybe you will remember this. Is 9/11 canon in the show? Like, does it?
I don't remember. Okay. I don't think so.
Because obviously in this first season, you know, it's taking place before, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know if like 9/11 is ever acknowledged in the show or not.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, like, big things happen or are threatened to happen, but it's like a specifically that I don't think so. I mean, to be fair, like you said, it's hermetic in a way, and that way extends to sort of only refer I don't believe they refer to like a Clinton or something like that.
Yeah, or, it's all fictional, know, like, presidents, politicians, all of that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't. I wouldn't know if they would do that specifically. But it's a good question, and obviously it's going to influence things going forward. But in this first episode, it's like this, it's this like sort of cordoned-off sort of thing in a way.
Yeah,
it's impressive how quickly it proceeds. Also, like it's used, it's as much used for the sort of shock value of the plane exploding as it is for Jack having to stay in CTU.
Yeah,
like he just gets he's about to go out to find Kim, and then he gets the call, and then he just immediately decides to stay, and that's the effective ending in it. Like it's like, well, I think we'll obviously see this a lot, but it's disasters and these things are as much a sort of onus on Jack and sort of like putting, like shifting the focus back to him as it is for their actual threat, which I guess sort of focus like goes into the sort of almost character-based thing that the show's going for. It's like as much character-based or like Jack-based as it is like on the process, on the procedural, on the action.
Yeah, no one else, you know. And I mean, it's a show with such a definite like point of view character, you know,
right?
That really, like, particularly early on, you know, one of the sort of big driving things is, you know, this impulse to, you know, protect and help his family, right, versus his duty to the country or whatever. And of course, like, mm-hmm. one of the things that happens is that those things then converge, you know, which, you know, is a particular, I think, a not necessarily unique to the United States, but it's conveyed in a particularly American way, right? These dual obligations of this father, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things, and one of the reasons the show, when you take it as a whole, is just, like, so ridiculous and over the top when you begin to consider all the things that happen, right? Right. I think we discussed the John Boyes video, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that video sort of takes as comedy is just, like, taking, you know, the 9 seasons of the show and being like, look at how many people die. Look at how many politicians are assassinated. Like, this is insane, right? In real life, this would be completely destabilizing. But like, really, the reason those things happen most of the time is like Jack has to stay engaged in this thing. Like you have to have this escalation, like the next thing has to be bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. When the guy that Walsh is with, whose name I don't even remember, I don't even know if we're given his name, but the guy that's passing off the information, when that guy gets killed, At first I noted it as like the first death in the show. And then I was like, oh wait, a whole plane of people already died. Yeah. There's no reflection on any of this. Like there's no, it's just grist for the plot mill in a lot of ways. Exactly. And it isn't until, you know, really primary characters are affected that it, that it becomes shocking, you know, because then when your baseline is, well, a whole plane of people just got blown up over the Mojave Desert, you know, then you really have to, the stakes of the show have been adjusted.
Yeah. And like speaking about the destabilizing part, there's almost like, at least I don't remember if it gets more and more complex as this season goes on, but there's almost something admirably small or like sort of, or small but important about it centering on David Palmer like potentially being assassinated. How, I don't remember who says it. Maybe it's Walsh, but saying that like that the first true black front runner for a president, if he's assassinated, then the country will be like will descend into chaos.
Will be torn apart. So, like,
Like this.
First
sort of
all,
like,
that's Jesse Jackson erasure.
Yeah, that too.
Second of all, I was pretty, you know, it's interesting the way that this show, the way it resonates in like current politics, you know?
Yeah.
Because I do think that one of the reasons the show hasn't stuck around is that the type of people who would most fetishize it and watch it like has shifted so much over the last 20 years, you know? I don't think a figure like Jack Bauer holds, you know, is capable of holding the kind of genuinely political influence that he did. I mean, Scalia cites him, right? And that just, you know, it. I just think that there are all of these fracture lines that the show, because of when it was made and because of its particular perspective on politics, just isn't capable of either predicting or confronting, even as the, you know, those contradictions were certainly there 20 years ago. But now, of course, it does read as pretty hopelessly naive, you know, in some ways. But it is kind of like a romanticized version of war and politics and all of this.
Yeah. And the country is very much kept, or like the possible countries that'd be interested are purposely kept very vague.
Yeah,
just like the international scene is we want to destabilize the U.S.
Yes, yeah.
Speaking of Walsh, I found him really fascinating in these first two episodes, simply because I feel like he's maybe the biggest red herring of these episodes, simply because he's very much set up as like this sort of by the book, very very like dependable sort of superior.
Yeah,
and he's just killed. He's just killed two episodes in.
Yeah, just unceremoniously dispatched.
Yeah.
And I think I'll say that, like, he, I think George Mason will, I'll end up feeling this way about George Mason, but Walsh seems to have, if not a real depth to his character, at least kind of an identifiable personality.
Yeah.
That I think in those early scenes where he shows up, like, gives you an idea of the world of the show, right? I did find, I don't know how you felt about this, but I did find that the sort of like gunfight in episode two, which takes up a big amount of time, like Jack and Walsh, I found it a little bit dull.
Maybe. I mean, like, I actually liked the gunfight itself.
Yeah.
Was kind of dull, but I think the actual like scenes of the like checking corners and like moving through was actually shot pretty well.
Yeah.
I thought like there's like the, especially there are like some, like, handheld or steady cam sort of ones of them moving through different rooms, like one takes that are like generally quite well done. And then the actual gunfight is just like sort of kind of like hard to tell where people are.
Yeah,
I guess there's the sort of mirror or window element involved, but even so, that doesn't quite really get at it. Maybe just because they kind of seem indestructible.
Yeah, and maybe part of my problem is that in retrospect, like, we go through all of that, and then like Walsh gets clipped like clumsily getting ready to climb over like the concrete barrier that leads to where Jack's car is at. And then he's sort of like, he's on the ground, you know, with like 8 bullets in him and sort of talking like he just, you know, went up some stairs a little too fast or something. And then just gets, you know, totally blasted again. I think that the show's action gets better than that. But I think it was interesting that the first space where like it's really high action is this kind of dark garage, but then they're also in an office. One of the things that's going on is just spatially, it definitely seems like we move from a very obvious exterior location to just like a studio space, you know, with some glass and desks and things set up. And that that I think is less exciting, you know, because then we get into like when they're on the rooftop there and there's like that ambient noise and stuff, it's like very very interesting and high tension, and then we end up in this dark space where you can't really see exactly what's going on, you know.
Speaking of outdoor spaces, I have to mention that one of the first shots in LA, like of this helicopter, is just taken from Heat. Like they just like it's even like in scope, like that shot, like it's sort of like cut off at the bottom, so like they just took it from Heat.
Yeah, and the satellite in episode one is from Enemy of the State. They just, you know, I think we used to do that a lot more. I don't know how much productions do that now, but I
think it's just all CGI, so they just enlist their stable of animators just to mock it up.
Well,
and
it's probably cheaper to, you know, if your studio already owns the rights to a particular property, it's probably much cheaper just to clip a quick shot from that and insert it.
Yeah, speaking of studio, like I not to be prurient, but the beginning of episode 2, like it's insane, like Mandy's like just like fully nude
just on the beach
in that shot, like in the desert, like she set fire to her like parachute and stuff, but like it's just like like maybe the television screens were just like, you know, smaller and not high def, like not like our transfers now, but like it's like I don't know how those aired on a regular network TV.
I mean there's no like actual nudity, but it is, I do think one of the things going on is that we're getting a very early and clear view of the way that this show thinks about women, which is which is not very much and not very well generally. I think that'll probably become more relevant as the plot lines develop, but you know,
of course.
It's like a strangely occult or almost like witchy kind of moment, which seems totally like completely at odds with what the show is doing. And almost immediately is dismissed. Like it's a very, but yeah, that moment stuck out as well as like this big bonfire and very, very strange.
I mean, Mandy, and like, we'll see her throughout the show sort of, but like, she always has that, like that's part of why, like, I like her character a lot. It's like, she has this such a, like she's more obviously filling an archetype than other people, like this sort of femme fatale or this sort of like seductive assassin sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like that's always a strange, like it, I wouldn't say it's out of place in 24 and like for like, and there's other people in the same mode as her, but like she just has this strange like sort of presence about her that like lends itself.
Yeah, and I think the performance is definitely playing that up, because on the one hand, like she's sort of acting like this kind of ditzy, drunk, you know, flying first class or whatever it is, right? And then, you know, turns on a dime and is just like a stone cold killer, right? I think that, and I don't have the actress's name right in front of me right now.
Mia Kirshner.
I think that her performance is embracing the like flat archetype, but really well. Like, I mean, I think that like one of the things this show needs more of, and I think eventually gets, is just people just gobbling up the scenery, right? I think the worst parts so far are just when everybody's kind of adhering to this kind of like stoic realism. And particularly in early scenes at like CTU and stuff, where no one really seems to have a lot of charisma, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
So as it goes on, I know that there are actors that are brought in to kind of like go big, you know? And I think part of that is just like matching the way that Kiefer Sutherland plays Jack Bauer when he's in Jack mode, which is just like a psycho, you know. So I'm interested to see. I'm excited for later on in the show when those performances start popping up more. But I think this is definitely an early one that is bringing some much needed like flavor to what's going on.
I will say it's almost funny how Tony and Nina are in a relationship, but like it's like played as it's downplayed as much as possible.
it's like the writers haven't decided yet.
Yeah, yeah, that's a fair way of putting it. I also forgot that CTU is specifically a military organization.
Yeah, I was, you know, I want to pay more attention to that as we go on, because obviously this is like a fictional precursor to you know, the kind of counterterrorism stuff that goes on now. But it is interesting to me the way it's situated inside the government, and also like why is it in Los Angeles? You know, I found myself wondering that. They actually, you probably know this, but I did read they were originally going to film the show in Toronto.
Yeah, well, I think just for I don't know, tax purposes or something.
Yeah,
like that.
But I do kind of wonder if it would have then been set on the East Coast.
Oh, good point.
As opposed to, you know, filming in LA, you might as well set it in LA, right? But I saw that, I wondered if originally, you know, it was going to be Toronto would be like a stand-in for like DC or that sort of Virginia military industrial complex. So, you
know. Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
The thing that will be happening throughout the show, I assume, is that like this sort of, because it's so freewheeling that it's hard to find necessarily a place to end. But I mean, there was there anything else that especially caught your attention?
There are two things. One is that in the very first scene with Jack Bauer, he takes a Jell-O out of the fridge and puts a spoon in it and doesn't take a bite, doesn't eat it. So given that this takes place over 24 hours, you know, I am curious if Jack Bauer ever eats anything. And it's also because I feel like Kiefer Sutherland is the kind of actor that could eat really well on screen. So I'm looking forward to that. I was disappointed. So I'm going to be watching for that. And the other is that I do want to give a shout out to the composer of the score, Sean Callery, because actually there are moments, particularly like the way that the music in CTU in the first episode sounds, that reminded me more than anything of like a John Carpenter score a little bit.
Ooh.
There were some good moments. I think that the acoustic-y stuff doesn't work as well. Like that, there are times where that really sticks out and isn't quite working for me, but there are some interesting moments of like kind of synthy dread and while still being melodic that I really liked. And I wasn't at all expecting to think about, you know, the way that the episodes were scored. But I think, I think sound is really important to this show, both because of the sort of iconic chunk of the clock and and also, you know, just in general, I think there's some interesting kind of sound design going on in these first couple episodes. But those are the only two things. Those are very minor things, but those are the only two things I had noted.
Yeah, apparently he did actually score every single episode, so we'll be hearing a lot more of his.
Yes, as well as a James Bond video game.
which one?
It was like late Brosnan era, so like after Goldeneye. I should have written that.
Everything or nothing.
Yeah, everything or nothing. There you go. He also did Designated Survivor, which might be something we'll talk about. And also, you know, it seems like a lot of people involved in this show worked on La Femme Nikita, the
of course
TV series adaption of
the TV series
of the Luc Besson movie. You know, I wonder how, and that was a Canadian show.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah, and it was on the USA network here. Yeah, so several people involved. Joel Surnow developed it. Callery did the score. There were other people involved. I think eventually some of the actors on 24 are people they pull from that. So I found that interesting as sort of like maybe a kind of like protean moment where the pieces of 24 begin to be put together. But
there's definitely a lot of ephemera that we can get to. We also failed to mention at the beginning that there's not one but two spin-offs of 24 in different countries. And like there was the India one that sort of showed in between season 8 and Live Another Day, I think.
Yeah.
But also they're literally last year they made a Japanese version of 24.
Yeah. And they're both very fun in that they're called 24 India and 24 Japan.
Yes, exactly.
So I wonder if the show's international cachet is higher than it is here now.
That's a good question. Yeah, like the show's definitely around, and like it's definitely something. I mean, they're still talking about potentially bringing it back, and I feel like it's, well, obviously it's part of the IP
yeah,
bonanza, yeah, state of things now, but still it's still interesting to me, like just seeing all these scenes spin-offs. So we'll definitely try to cover those also in their due time.
I do wonder if, you know, one of the reasons that there's been some international adaptions, particularly the Japan one. I think the India one is a little more directly connected to,
sure,
the American show. But I wonder if part of the Japan one is like 24 has such a specific gimmick. And if you want to do that, mm-hmm, gimmick, I don't know that there's any way you could do it without just like doing the IP, right?
yeah, that's true.
You know, I think that there's like a gray zone of where those things are like legally protected by copyright and whatnot. Like, you know, they didn't invent they didn't invent real time, and you know they didn't invent this, you know, filming something in 24 hours or whatever. But I do wonder if it's just like, if you want to do this kind of thing, if you have no other choice but to sort of be like, yeah, okay, so we're doing 24, but it's in Japan. You know,
yeah. One thing I just want to shout out, a very odd shot of Walsh just reflected in the table. Just while he's talking with Jack, it's just like this shot of him upside down, then it quickly like a whip pan up to him, just him in profile.
Yeah, you know, it's good to have a real director directing your TV show.
That's true.
Someone who has made movies, mm-hmm, and I'm a little bit disappointed because there is a director that we will get to eventually who directed 65 episodes of this show. And I'm worried that if their visual style is not as dynamic and interesting as these early episodes, that I might dread seeing that name in the credits as we go on. No offense to their work, which I have not experienced yet, but 65 episodes is a lot to get the one person on a TV show like this. So
yes, definitely. Yes, a lot to explore, and I hope that you, the listener, will join us for our extended exploration of this strange and sort of wonderful and sort of horrible television series. We also just say that we're like, neither of us are very much TV people. Like,
this is an like, anti-TV podcast about television.
Exactly. So forewarning about that, but as you can already tell, there's a good deal of appreciation along with the skepticism. So we'll hope that you will bear with us on that, and with the at least 5-year run of this show, we'll see how long it ends up being. But yeah, thank you for joining us.
I'm excited to, you know, hear what people have to say. So hopefully they continue with us on our march into hell with Jack Bauer.